Centre for hosting us this evening. Really nice to hear the mention of Matthew Glover there, which is not a poem we're going to hear this evening, but was the first poem that Roger Langley preserved, felt that meant that he really could actually have a shot at this poetry game. A wonderful piece of writing it is. Well, okay, so it really is a pleasure to be standing here on this cold February night to see Dragon Hall so full. Thank you all for coming. Many of you will know already R.F. Langley. You will know something about him and why his name has brought together such a brilliant gathering of readers from whom we will be hearing shortly. For those of you who don't know, I thought I would just give a little biographical sketch to accompany this fine self-portrait of the author, as well as being a writer. Roger Langley was also a gifted painter and draftsman. So, Roger Francis Langley was born in Rugby on 23rd of October 1938. He was the eldest son of a schoolteacher. The family lived in Stonnell, South Staffordshire, near the town of Walsall. In 1957, he went to Jesus College, Cambridge, to study English literature. There, he met Jeremy J.H. Prynne, with whom he formed a close friendship. On graduation, they undertook a trip to Italy to study Quattrocento art and architecture, inspired by the writings of Ezra Pound and the art criticism of Adrian Stokes. After Cambridge, Langley trained as a teacher and went on to teach at several secondary schools in the West Midlands. He especially enjoyed teaching sixth form pupils for A-level English, and he also gave extracurricular evening classes at his home in art history. In 1972, he married Barbara. The couple settled in the village of Shenston and had two children, Ruth and Eric. I'm delighted to say that all these people I've mentioned are here this evening. The Langley family often went on holidays to the county of Suffolk, where Roger took pleasure in visiting its many medieval churches. I think he would particularly appreciate Dragon Hall and the fine dragon and the spandrel up there. In 1999, Langley retired from teaching and he moved with Barbara to Bramfield in Suffolk, where he had long admired the 17th century memorial sculpture by Nicholas Stone in the local church. And I do want to make a day trip if you've never been to Bramfield Church to see that absolutely wondrous piece of carving. There is a piece of memorial sculpture by Nicholas Stone in the church just off Tombland down the road here in Norwich, but it's not nearly as good, so don't take that as a guide to what you can do. In the lanes of Suffolk and at nearby nature reserves, Roger was able to pursue his interests in entomology and ornithology, while holidays to Italy allowed him to renew firsthand his knowledge of Renaissance art. He wrote more regularly and prolifically than he had before, and he sometimes travelled to give readings of his verse. He died in Bramfield on 25th of January 2011. So the next thing I feel I should say to you all is that I'm sorry I am not Michael Schmidt, who you, some of you will know, is the general editor of Carcanet, published the complete poems, and maybe we could have the slide of the Carcanet books. So these are the three books of poetry that Carcanet published of R.F. Langley. Each featuring a detail from one of those medieval Suffolk churches. So Michael prompted the idea for this evening. We were going to celebrate not only Roger Langley's writing, but also his long association with the magazine PM Review, which recently marked its 43rd year of publication with a handsome new redesign. Here it is, the latest issue. Unfortunately, Michael can't now be with us this evening. As his representative, though, he has sent us a free box of the latest issue of the magazine, so if you haven't already, do pick up a copy of that during the interval. Among many good things to read, it contains the first of a new series of extracts from R.F. Langley's journals. These journals are the record that he kept in prose of meditative experiences that he had, often while out walking in the countryside or standing in a church, or before of painting, and these often fed into his poetry. PN Review began to publish entries from the journals in 2002, and in 2006 a selection appeared in book form from the publisher Shearsman. And over the last decade, it has been recognized as a classic for modern nature writing. So when I was editing Roger's poems, I was very grateful to his wife, Barbara, for allowing me to work with a set of notebooks in which Roger had kept material relevant to their writing and publication. At the back of one of these notebooks was tucked some correspondence with Michael Schmidt. In a letter from 1994, he writes in high praise of Roger's wonderful verse, and he remarks, "It is a great pleasure for an editor to find a poet such as you unmarred by the marketing culture that so disables contemporary muses." Which I think is a very nice way of saying something very true about Roger Langley, which is that you could hardly have imagined a writer less motivated by self-promotion. He had, at that point, been publishing through small presses and magazines since the 1970s, and in 1994, he put together a book which gathered all his work to date, and which was called, with characteristic accuracy and modesty, 12 Poems. In 2000, when Carcanet published the volume called Collected Poems, that number had, quite famously, only gone up to 17. In the last decade of his life, however, he enjoyed a period of relatively vigorous activity in his writing, and we will be hearing a number of those great late poems this evening. The Complete Poems is the book that last year brought all this writing together, 48 poems in total by the end. I like to imagine that the excellent reviews that it has had so far are being read by Roger somewhere, somehow, and that he's taking them with a mix of gruff pride and real modesty. I reviewed the original Collected Poems on the right back in 2000. I reviewed it very enthusiastically, and this was the beginning of our friendship. He wrote me a letter in which he said, "My goodness, nobody will say better for me than that." So, to give you an idea of what's coming up this evening, the next speaker that you hear will be Roger Langley himself, recorded almost exactly 11 years ago to the night in the drama studio up at UEA. He's going to read his poem Poor Moth, introducing it in his own inimitable way. If we can have the next slide, Jonathan. This is a photo of Roger in full flow at a reading. All I would add in advance of what he has to say is that he does describe it as a Jack poem. And this refers to the fact that it features his invented creature or person or sprite called Jack, who brings a great mischievous imaginative energy to a set of poems that he wrote. We will be hearing more about Jack in the second half of the evening when his friend, Roger's friend, but also Jack's friend too, no doubt, J.H. Prynne, reads another of the Jack poems. Roger will be followed by Julia Blackburn, another friend and fellow writer, then the poet Peter Hughes, who reviews the Complete Poems very thoughtfully in the latest peer review. Then Roger's daughter Ruth will read the poem The Upshot. And finally, Fern Richards, who is currently a student on the Writing in the Modern World MA at UEA, will be giving us her reading of one of Roger's journal entries. The journals, I should add, are now a set text up at UEA on a final year module called Stop, Look, Listen, taught by my colleague, Stephen Benson, and the wonderful effect they have on the students who read them. Then there will be the short interval, and then we'll resume with another run of poems. So, before I leave you with Roger himself, I'd just like to start off this evening by reading the last poem that he ever wrote. It's also the shortest poem he ever wrote, and in many ways perhaps the simplest, but it still has that magical quality that I associate with all his writing. It was intended for publication in a book of photographic portraits of poets that didn't appear, or has not yet appeared. So I think we can think of it as another kind of self-portrait. Roger didn't leave any clues about the origin of this poem in his notebooks. My guess is that it refers to an episode in the life of the film director Ingmar Bergman, whose work Roger admired, while he was filming the medieval drama The Seventh Seal. Perhaps someone here tonight may be able to help me with my guesswork. I've got a feeling it will be found maybe in the memoirs of Ingmar Bergman. In any case, it tells a little story that I think applies nicely to us this evening also. as a group of people assembled in honour of what the imagination can make of the world around us. Hopefully you will see what I mean by that. So the poem is called You with Your Visions and Dreams. So this will be as if the script girl said, helping to hand out medieval costumes. As if the sound crew nodded, folding oilskins, pulling on Icelandic sweaters. As if the makeup man was sad to say, blowing the snowflakes off his broad-brimmed hat. At which a great bird, flat-winged, high up, came floating from behind the firs. The way things were had kept it hidden until then, but now it circled round and we dropped everything to watch. I thought, this is the way we make the best movies here in Sweden. And now, what do you like now?
So that was the first of the Jack poems then, that got Jack going, and I'll continue before I get round to the landfill pair with another Jack poem called Poor Moth, which is a phrase that Ruskin used, saying that we were all poor moths because we fly to the fire and get burnt, we fly to the candle and get burnt. Perhaps I might say about this, I was a school teacher for many, many years, 40 years was it, I can't remember, wouldn't dare to count that much, but still. And I remember the first job I ever had was a place called Shire Oak, near Brown Hills in the Midlands, which was a nice school, and it had an interesting pupil in it called Anslow. And one dinner hour he met me amongst the coats in the racks in the school, and stood looking at me for a moment or two. I was on duty, and he said to me, "Sir, what are we here for?" And I said, "You are here to have your dinner, Angela, quite possibly to get your coat and have the afternoon off. I don't know." He said, "No, I don't mean that. I mean, what are we here for? Like, I'm standing here with hands and hair and ears and nose and feet and..." You've got the same, "What the bloody hell are we doing here, for God's sake, sir? Tell me, what are we doing here?" He's in quite a state. So I said, "I have no answer to that, Angela. I'm sorry about that, sir. Just get your coat or whatever." I remember Angela, a fine student, Angela, a deep thinking lad. But everybody has these moments, don't they? Let me quote from Thomas Nagel, is it, or? Yes, I think Thomas Nagel is how you say his name. Rather splendid book called Mortal Questions. I like throwing these extra quotes in, they give status to my poem when I find it. he's talking about the difficulties of being alive and knowing whether to put a subjective interpretation upon the universe or whether to try and take the thing from a massive objective viewpoint where you're nothing at all but just absurd in a Sartre, in an existential sort of sense. And he says, "Perhaps the problem takes its purest form in a sense of incredulity that one should be anyone in particular, a specific individual of a particular species existing at a particular time and place in the universe," which presumably you've all felt that it is rather peculiar to be R.F. Langley standing here in front of you lot at this particular time, this particular... What is it for, sir? What the hell are we doing here? I mean, Angelo and Thomas Nagel were more or less the same person at the time. And then Nagel's other famous essay is one. It's called "What's It Like to Be a Bat?" Perhaps you've read that one. "What It's Like to Be a Bat?" And that that hinges upon a sort of attack upon the idea that you could replicate human intelligence by a machine. And his crunch line is, No matter how that form may vary, the fact that an organism has conscious experience at all means basically that there is something it is like to be that organism. Something it is like to be that organism. It's nothing that it's like to be a computer, you see. I mean, what's it like to be a computer? There isn't an answer to that. What's it like to be a bat? There's a conceivable answer to that, even if you can't get to it, is it not? Fundamentally, an organism has conscious mind, mental states, if and only if there is something that it's like to be that organism. And that's in my mind as well. And then I'm in a pub at a place called Stunham Aspel in Suffolk. I'm in the urinal of the pub. The only good poem I know that's been written in a urinal, so there we go. And the walls are painted bright green, and on the walls there are dozens of little moths, little grass moths. If you know what grass moths look like, you're okay. My poems are very specific, you have to know such things. All right, so they're tiny little moths with long pointed snouts, and they've got little eyes like fish eyes. They've got little pupils in them, except they're not pupils, they're just shadows in the middle of their eyes, because moths don't really have pupils in their eyes. Okay, and they fold themselves up like little cigarettes. They roll their wings around their bodies, and they come in from the grass outside through the windows, and this urinal was full of them. There was a lot of them on the green walls. Hence, poor moth, you see. Now, you're all equipped now, okay? Right, here we go. This is the last Jack poem. The other was the first. This is the last. Poor moth. Oh, there's one other thing I want to say, and that is that Hume, David Hume, the philosopher, when he thought a lot, always began to feel that thinking was a waste of time, never explained anything. And so he used to go away and play backgammon with his friends in order to keep himself going. He drove him mad being a philosopher, he worked himself into a frenzy, he gave it up, he went and played backgammon, got things going again, then went back to be a philosopher afterwards and he cooled off a bit. So there's a bit of that David Hume here too. Now really, we'll do it now. Okay, here we go. Reasons run out, and we are ready to play backgammon once again. Come on, I say. I know when I am being watched. Even in the washroom, here's a window left unlatched, and various small monsters have nipped softly in to take up key positions amongst some.
Okay, well, nothing it's like to be a computer, but I think we'll move on to. Should we do that?
Yes, certainly.
To interrupt Roger in full flow.
But you can play him again later.
Yeah, we'll come back to him.
Fight back on the computer. Stay on
social. Okay, all right. Okay, so having just put computers down as having their consciousness. computer was ahead of us. So before machines take over the world, I'm delighted to welcome Julia Blackburn to the stage, who is very much a person and is going to read to us from A Letter of Hope.
Not breakdown, unless I break down the topic, then you can accept it there. Gosh, when I hear Roger talking like that, he came once to stay with us in Italy and he disappeared into a shrubbery of weeds and kept on hearing this thing of cracking. Look at those paps. This sort of concentrating the detail of things. I got to know Roger because he and Barbara moved to Bramfield, where I live, and me and my late husband Herman became friends with them. We used to go and have meals, we'd go on expeditions, and at a certain point Roger said that he was going to do seminars and tell us about modern poetry, because we clearly didn't know enough, which was true. So we went over for seminar evenings a few times, and he was wonderful just in this grasp of the huge as well as the particular. And then he was persuaded against his better judgment. He said, Herbert and I said, we want to have private tutorials on your poems, because we'd read them and got stuck with them. So he agreed to do, I think we did 3 or 4, where he'd take a poem, and then he would bring out the journal that was relevant to the poem, and we'd go through it line by line. And I think after the 3rd or 4th of these fascinating sessions, because of this way that this mind could wander and travel and encompass so much, whether it was Beatles or or Quattrocento or philosophy, whatever it was. He then said, maybe you'd like to take some of the journals back with you home and you can read them at home. So, sort of, with great trepidation and a great sense of sort of honour, we took first one volume and then another and read them. And the thing, if you see Roger's journals, you see that they are so exquisite in the way that his writing is like his thinking. It has a kind of quality of steadiness and knowing what it's doing, even if sometimes you miss the point of where it's quite leading. And so then we spent a long time reading those and then talked with him about the PN review things that made marks, that made post-it notes for the ones that we thought were good. And got that. It was just very, very interesting, wonderful to do. And he used to, when he'd written a new poem, he'd always drop a copy round, and sometimes with a note. And so what I'm going to do is read the letter he wrote and dropped in with his latest poem, and then read the poem. Julia and Herman. Here is my latest effort, just accepted by the London Review of Books to be published sometime during the next 9 months. It is more evasive than some, especially than the Jack poems. Why? I need to activate less explicit scenarios so that wider and deeper reverberations are sounded, more like I used to do nearer the beginning of my writing. I intended it to be something of a wild series of short poems, all centred on the image of a wine glass full of water on the windowsill. I was attracted by Giacometti saying no artist could ever copy such an objective thing, and Stokes saying that we depend for our sanity on being able to rely on the consistency of such objective things. Both of them chanced to use the image of a glass of water as their examples. I've told you all this before. Sorry. So the wine glass began clear, then a reflection of the morning sunlight on its lip looked like a coruscating thistle seed. So the image of thistles came into it, thus proving how hard it is to keep to the plain object. And things dissolved more and more. Goldfinches came to strip the thistle with their gold and white wings. The thistle became briefly a teasel. Certain psychological situations from Winnicott and Laplanche intervened. You begin to meet this mind, don't you? The objective and the subjective fused at the tip of a wading bird's beak as it pecked its own reflection in the mud, in the blue, reflecting mud, which seemed like the sky as well as the water. Then a picture by a Dutch artist called Cornelis van Poelenburgh, which I saw in London, involved itself, illustrating the myth of Hersey and Mercury, which eventually sorted out to the plot of As You Like It, because I needed the concept of inventing a lie which turned out to be the truth in spite of oneself. All to resolve the dilemma of what is and what is not. The fact, the wine glass, the thing itself. Then a chaffinch, because there didn't happen to be any goldfinches about, and I wanted it to be pink. In the yew outside our bedroom window, behind the wine glass, on the windowsill. And the matter of the consonant shift from P to F, which made Pater into father and pink into finch. Chaffinches say pink, pink when they are agitated, of course, and that is why finches are called finches. All this and more, lots more. But what should result is a sequence of images and events which make some sort of emotional sense, go on some sort of a journey, and come to some sort of a home at the last, back to the village after the trip to the Holy Land. With a rich suggestivity and a sort of logic behind them, which could be sorted out on all sorts of levels. Even Jungian ones, I half think, having been reading Symbols of the Collective Unconscious again lately, though I would never set out to deal in any open way with that. Thanks for the exceptionally fine drama the other night, Roger. So, yes, there's an introduction to the way of his, the workings of his mind, and this then is the poem, Still Life with Wine Glass. A wine glass of water on the windowsill where it will catch the light. Now be quiet while I think and groan and blink. I'm anxious about the wine glass. It's an expert at staying awake. How can it ever close its eyes? It's too good a defence against an easy sleep under the trees. The wine glass stands fast in a gale of sunlight, where there is one undamaged thistle seed caught on its rim, moving its long filaments through blue to orange, slowly exploring the glorious furniture. Old Harry has opened that bundle again. Oh well. Tuck up your golden sleeves, fetch out the white gloves. We'll go right through the thistle seeds till we find Jenny. The finch's mother told him about the teasels. He consults them daily with fierce resignation. His findings, however, fluff out and cream off, catching the drift. Mum was the word, but she did give a nod. So they sidled up close, put a foot on its neck, and kiss, 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 kiss. Sometimes they stopped pecking to watch what they could not follow. Parachutes whispering away. Milk and magenta, a gob of the cotton torn from the button, thrown into despair. So, there's nothing remains of what we see, does it? Does it? Tumbled about in the air. We speak from out there and we keep things alive. The wine glass reminds me of wading birds, when their beaks meet their beaks as they feed on a mirror of mud and mark here as a point in the water that's deep in the sky. Fetch me a folding chair. Set it up by the south door. This is etiquette. I am the ticket collector. Nothing comes in but thistle down, which scarcely touches the floor and was never supposed to pay. New pennies spun into the droning paternoster. How close Jenny rose to the top, then turned back, and you lost her. Each bubble considered the rest as it chose its place. Out in the morning, everything settled before I could look. Down centre is a tomb or shrine. The sun is shining on the corner of a panel set into its side. It's all paid on the nail. None of it is mine. Way off and running strongly through the hazy slate blue sky, that must be Rosie Mercury, bent on a quest. He did choose the third sister. Jenny wasn't there. Recent incidents are never seen in the crystal ball. Only a procession of distant people passing below a ruined wall, brightly lit, but microscopically small. Soft pappus strings out like a search party. It's looking for the concealed figure of a god. Whoever dropped him in the clump of weeds forgot him, so they could seek him in the sacred hunt. Remember how the wine glass put its foot down, chip-chop, happy to be home. Next. Invent a religious uncle. He was the one who taught you elocution when you lived in the forest. Give me the details. I want your whole story clear in my mind. Rabbits are kindling in their burrows. Tomorrow, Harry will meet an uncle, just as you described him. They will sit down together in the sun and puff at the dandelion. A bumper. Little fingers that were hidden flicked the dice. The cunning rascals counted on convincing you these were the lucky accidents of a busy day, set, at the end of it, in solid ice. The window, the wine glass, a yew tree inside it, upside down, far away, and very distinct. A cautious chaffinch sits tight through the shift of the consonants. The needles are green. The bird knows it is pink.
Hello, everybody. It's a great pleasure to be here this evening for such a fine purpose. I'm going to read a poem by Roger called Cook Team. At least that's what it's called now. But first I'm going to say a few words about this book, which is everything. I reviewed it in the the current Review. Let's just read a few bits from that. This book already feels like a classic. This may partly be because some of the poems have been familiar texts since they first appeared in the pamphlet Hem, published by Nigel Wheals' Infernal Methods Press back in 1978. It may be because of the bright sense of patience, attentiveness, and linguistic alacrity which characterised the writing from the start. It's significant that the start was not an early one. When the first pamphlet appeared, Langley was 40 years old, and when 12 poems, which included the poems from Hem, came out from the same press in 1994, the author was 56. Man Jack, the first poem in the complete poems, is a good introduction to Roger Langley. Jack became a kind of alter ego, a talismanic word whose multifarious meanings he delighted in investigating and then incorporating into poems. Your little cousin, Jack, a step ahead, deep in the hedge, on edge, a kiss, a rim, at pinch, in place, turn face and tip, a brim. Each inch of him, the folded leaf, the important straw. Langley's sound seemed to flicker and glint, yet the endless activity is presented in elegant 10-syllable lines. This carefully regulated line will frequently frame observed or imagined bustle as he scrutinises birds, insects, details of a painting, and foregrounds the tantalising qualities of individual words. 16 years ago, Roger sent me a poem called Rauschenberg. For a festschrift I was editing for Peter Riley, it's this book, April I, for Peter's 60th birthday. Characteristically, the poem drew upon his reading and reflections about art and philosophy. It elegantly dances its way to its absence of conclusions, referring to artworks Robert Rauschenberg made after trips to Italy and North Africa with Cy Twombly in the early 1950s. These included the little boxes, scatole personali, containing found objects, bits of earth and stick, fragments of natural and man-made material. There's a little quote. Beetles and sticks in a box, bright bait. You notice what has gone into the picture, bite it. It can't be expected to wait. Langley's poem sees the day, yet register its myriad manifestations, rushing past and away. Crisply textured words veer off into new contexts and ambiguities. Quote, some of the cliff carves flat, the rest ducks and runs like a rat. So Langley, connoisseur of Shakespeare, of painting, and of the flora and fauna of Suffolk, loved to locate his precise observations in contexts of linguistic play. His work is a rare blend of rigorous delineation and playfulness. He studied English at Cambridge, as we've heard, but it was his reading of American poets such as Pound, Olson, Creeley and Dorn that triggered his own poetry. He was interested in theories of art and perception too, and these interests are evident throughout the Rauschenberg poem, which is the one I'm going to read under a different title. Another quote, ideas of perception. You picked a leaf off the road. What is it when it reaches the sea? The gulls are white, flap over sprats in the foam. Call it an episode when they tumble together to make it one. The cliff is history. You throw yourself in where the fish are thickest. Take hold of a word and turn it on. Tourbillon. A blade is so sharp it can dance around the joint. The Rauschenberg poem is in 8-syllable lines, the unwavering nature of which helps to foreground the artifice of the writing. The above extract seems to enact a series of stages of perception, reflection, and the processes of composition until we arrive at the image of the knife. Before its appearance in the complete poems, the name of the Rauschenberg poem was changed from Rauschenberg to Kupfding. Lang has chosen to focus not so much on the finished artwork, but on the qualities of expertise and deftness. Kupfding appears in the story by Chuang Tzu, which Langley read in the translation by Burton Watson. And I'm going to read one of these source texts, the relevant chunk now. The secrets of caring for life. Your life has a limit, but knowledge has none. If you use what is limited to pursue what has no limit, you will be in danger. If you understand this and still strive for knowledge, you will be in danger for certain. If you do good, stay away from fame. If you do evil, stay away from punishments. Follow the middle, go by what is constant, and you can stay in one piece. Keep yourself alive. Look after your parents. Live out your years. Kupfding was cutting up an ox for Lord Huan Hui. At every touch of his hand, every heave of his shoulder, every move of his feet, every thrust of his knee, zip, zoop, he slithered the knife, along with a zing. And all was in perfect rhythm, as though he were performing the dance of the mulberry grove, or keeping time to the Qingshou music. "Ah, this is marvellous," said Lord Wen Hui. "Imagine skill reaching such heights." Kupfding laid down his knife and replied, "What I care about is the way, which goes beyond skill. When I first began cutting up oxen, all I could see was the ox itself. After 3 years, I no longer saw the whole ox. Now I go at it by spirit and don't look with my eyes. Perception and understanding have come to a stop, and spirit moves where it wants. I go along with the natural makeup. I strike in the big hollows. I guide the knife through the big openings and follow things as they are, so I never touch the smallest ligament or tendon, much less a main joint. A good cook changes his knife once a year because he cuts. A mediocre cook changes his knife once a month because he hacks. I've had this knife of mine for 19 years, and I've cut up thousands of oxen with it, and yet the blade is as good as when it was first made. There are spaces between the joints, and the blade of the knife has really no thickness. If you insert what has no thickness into such spaces, then there's plenty of room, more than enough for the blade to play about in. That's why after 19 years, the blade of my knife is still as good as when it first came from the grindstone." "Excellent," said Lord Wen Hui. "I have heard the words of Kupfding and learned how to care for life." Well, I think Kupfding is quite a good image for Roger Langley, poet and draftsman. And now I'm going to read the poem itself. Kupfding. Circumstances analogous to life and death, house cleaning or clutter, Dante or an old shirt, it's there to cut but not to chop. Between the knuckle bones it's soft as butter. Or you picked a leaf off the road. What is it when it reaches the sea? The gulls are a white flap over sprats in the foam. Call it an episode when they tumble together to make it one. The cliff is history. You throw yourself in where the fish are thickest. Take hold of a word and turn it on. Tourbillon. A blade is so sharp it can dance round the joint. Silvery energies argue the point. The carcass of an ox flops open. Shall we leave it at that? Some of the cliff carves flat, the rest ducks and runs like a rat. Look about and wipe the knife, but there's more. There's more. Rubbing it out will prove there's no nub of the matter. There are too many eyes for your own eyes to catch in the scatter. 12 blank sheets of paper hung up on a string. the joy of perpetual bicker, your seat at the open door, the shutters bang back, a dark acrobat who somersaults through to rob a few of the glittering company. Is there a wife for a Viking? A pair of socks in a poem. Beetles and sticks in a box. Bright bait. Bright bait. You notice what has gone into the picture. Bite it. It can't be expected to wait.
I'm one of two people who get to say dad rather than Langu. So I'm Ruth Langu, Roger's daughter, and by trade, I'm slightly ashamed to say, after he locked computers only a few minutes ago, I'm a digital content data strategist. That career choice probably sounds as far removed from the interests of my father, the poet, literature and art history teacher, as you could possibly get. But I like to think that if he was still around, we might find some areas of overlap, some interesting points of contact between the questions prompted by our chosen paths. I capture academic writing as data and then interrogate it with computer-run scripts, in order to describe it, categorise it, and build connections around it. I use semantic information, subject discipline taxonomies and vocabularies in order to map and describe, or attempt to describe, knowledge. Some of the questions my team wrestle with feel familiar Langley territory. What are the multiple senses of this particular word? How does its context, etymology, and the history of its use affect the word's meaning right here? As we categorise and define, we worry about whether we are pinning meaning down and being too prescriptive. Are we providing too many answers for the reader, making connections with other texts or ideas which they should discover for themselves? All questions I know Dad would have had something to say about, and some of which I know Jeremy Noltod, who is a sensitive editor, had to consider when compiling the complete works. How much information should be provided for the reader? When all this self-doubt becomes too much, I point my team to a motivational poster on my office wall. It is, of course, a quotation from R.F. Lemmy. He said, "I love things when they're incredibly precise and yet move off all over the place as well. The tighter, the wider." That love of the particular, that belief that it is crucial to know what kind of bird you are listening to and to pay close, careful, still attention to it, turns out to be as important for a data strategist as it was for this poet. Because once you know something precisely, far from being tied down by a narrow definition or answer, you are able to connect with it, link it, deepen your experience of it through its relationships, context, references, illusions and memories, the tighter, the wider. The poem I'm about to read, The Upshot, feels like climbing into a time machine back to my childhood for me. The poem smells of the sweet, sharp, green reek of damp and rotten wood in decrepit Westall Church as it was then in the 70s and 80s. You might stumble on a small corpse of a mouse by the font, or browse the visitor's book where you would find a roll call of Langley friends and family, many of whom are here tonight. To lapse into banal anecdote for a moment, in that visitor's book you would also find quite an entertaining dispute between Dad and a stranger who unwisely commented that the whole place could do with a polish to show that someone cared. I will leave Dad's response to your imagination. It isn't difficult for me to picture Dad as I read this poem, sitting silently for hours in a pew in Westall Church, concentrating on the poppy-haired bench hens who inspired the eight absurd captains in The Upshot, or watching the sunlight fall from the doorway into the gloom where he sat. But I shall stop before I am tempted to pin any more down, and just read a poem and let you provide the connections. It's my day off. The upshot. We leave unachieved in the summer dusk. There was no need for you rather than me. Here is the unalterable truth. Outside the open door, peculiar bugbears adopt the dark. Then Kate passes across. Next to nothing depends on her coming in. Here are the 8 absurd captains, whether they are seen or not. Here their 16 certain shadows on the whitewashed wall. Here 100 ruffles, grey and jade, coolly laid. My hands and feet are already lost in this country, with the immediate sadness which no one has to believe. The captains have not moved, though earlier the peep of day had staked everything on the ear and shoulder of just one of them. But soon he was smoothly snubbed like the other 7. Now the individual is unimportant, but 8 determined men stand penniless, never a glance in the silver evening. The odd outside matter that twirled around all day in the blebs of gold needs thinking about. Gorgeous, like looking in a pool. My chickens drill and strut, piping my own particulars. I won't leave it empty. I save a cricket on a hassock. Anything that moves, lies, quirks, shrugs can make a face and wink. The drollery of that fiery ear. A hunch I held sparkling for some hours, then sacked with the real severity inherent in the air of this place. My patent excitement is poppycock, which needed volunteers. There's a chance Kate saw more by not coming in, but I only peer at the backs of the 8 deaf heads. In here we're less lit from the sky. We count our 24 and are in jeopardy. It is my sleeve creaking, or a faraway kittiwake baffled by woods, brushing my ear with a jeweller's fingers. Which leave what? Next to nothing. So little and so icy that the floor flattens in the afterglow, and a multitude stands up. They stand up but don't go, all ready, not started, full stretch in their rigid heads. Now when I need it, I'm so close to emptiness. But I know too much about each of these 8 fixed faces. Unless you ask about the eyes, you do. Here's the opening for the 100 tricks Kate took by walking across, not looking in. We leave unachieved in the summer dusk. There are no maps of moonlight. Things stand further off. We find peace in the room, and don't ask what won't be answered. We don't know what we see, so there is more here. More here. Right. So, okay, so the poem you've just heard is the upshot, which was already announced, sorry. Among other things, it's about Westall Church, which you've also heard. I can say this for 2 reasons, partly because Ruth said it, and also because R.F. Langley did it in an interview, which means I can cite it. It sort of admits the 8 absurd captains and poppycock are talking about the poppyhead Benchems. They're in the south or Bowen aisle of the church, which I visited a couple of years ago. And it was the first time I'd actually seen a poppyhead, because it's not really something you see in churches around where I'm from. They're sort of weird wooden knotty things sticking up from the ends of the pews. They don't look anything like the sort of poppyheads I was imagining before I walked in. They're actually sort of bulbous and bug-like and standoffish. I actually couldn't see there was much to like about them. But I've read the journals and I've read the upshots, and I prepared myself to meet with something charming, tricksome and almost human, which I didn't. Perhaps that's just a matter of taste. But already in the disconnect between expectation and reality, I was brushed off, made a fool of by my hopes about a group of wooden carvings. It was slightly embarrassing. The reason I come to expect something which I didn't, in all honesty, encounter was partly the fault of a journal entry from August 1994, which I'm going to read to you in a minute. The journals are, in Langley's words, an impromptu archive of raw material description to do with what Ruskin advocated as the prime necessity, that of seeing. They're sort of set-piece prose descriptions. Some of them are in this book, which is very nice, and if you've done Stephen's course, you'll have a copy. Some of them are in peer review, but most of them aren't published. So they're often feed-in for poems in their own right, though they're impressive things to read. They've got the record of the attentive work, play and foolery, which are required to bring things out of our assumptions and into themselves. I say foolery because this particular entry documents a simple game which Langley plays with the bench ends. He puts his hat down on one of them, then he acts as if he's about to pick it up, and then he doesn't. And then he walks around watching what the bench ends are going to do. Then he puts it back on his own head, and then he tries and fails to throw it onto another distant poppy head. It's all quite simple and a bit silly, but it sets up quite an intense drama which transforms the objects of description and the observer himself. What does it turn them into? It's almost impossible to explain, which is why I'm going to read the thing. Langley looks at things with an improvisational mischief, bringing in variables which take the poor sight of human beings, our inability to know what we see, and turns it into a mechanism for releasing what's inherent or possible in the things being observed. By messing about and playing games, we can become like the Shakespearean fool who shows the truth through punning and play. I did write a long examination of the way in which Langley's description in this journal entry performs this motion of accepting fallibility, playing games, and productively revealing deeper uncertainties. And it was really good, honestly. And then I decided that it's probably better to let Langley speak for himself, so I'm going to do that. So this is an entry from August 1994, which I'm going to read the whole thing. Okay. Westhall again. Overcast weather, unstressed. The Bowen Isle is where whatever is about to be could be again, but nothing is going to be taken by storm. The colours are comfortable, and a tractor is ploughing somewhere nearby, so silence and remoteness are only inferred. No thistledown comes in, even when I leave the door open and there's a draught. Here are the 16 bench ends to the south of the aisle. I get to know their poppy heads some more. Eventually I put my Panama hat on the third one from the back. It punches the folded crown half out, and the hat tilts as if it were facing along the bench towards the head at the inner end, against the wall, as if it were pushed back of a forehead. Its straw is slightly brighter and more assertive than the colour of the walls, its black band a trifle darker than the wood and the shadows. It stands out. It makes the head into a head. I'm aware of how all the other heads, 15 of them, look straight to their front, but are only pretending not to notice it. They refuse to look. Even the one facing it doesn't focus on it, but stares rigidly through it. I begin to play to that. I walk away, up the aisle, and look back. From behind, the curled sides of the poppy head emerge from beneath the brim, like long hair swept up at its tips, left and right. A woman wearing a man's hat, or a youth with long hair. The neck is very much neck, and the shoulders, shoulders. As I circle round and catch it sideways, the face is not there, only flatness. But again, from the north, from any angle behind it, a person is rather shockingly present, with something too of a scarecrow. The hat becomes stuff because it is on a thing. The poppy head becomes human because it has a hat on it. The exchange rocks to and fro interestingly and a little worryingly. I walk up the aisle as if to pick the hat off. Then I don't do it, but step past and spin round quickly. Yes. The other heads are pretending, even more strenuously, not to be surprised, not to be at all concerned. But the swirls of grooves on their faces are raised eyebrows now. But not one of them was tricked into turning a hair or blinking. They are jealous because they have no hats. Yet wearing a hat is a pitiable thing, unworthy of a bench end, and the third one up has been reduced in status as well as enhanced. Humanised. Humanisation is not all benefit. It involves playing games. For this reason, too, the others don't look. They're embarrassed. One of them has been changed, probably forever. Always it will be the one that wore the hat. I'm tempted to move the hat to the head facing it from the inner end of the same bench to even things out,
since these two face each other always. But that would spoil the variation I have caused, blunt the distinction. The inner one can remain the one I especially chose to leave unhatted, and its expression will always register that. It knows I have it at my beck and call like this. Its rigidity and changelessness say that I have decided, it knows, never to put a straw Panama hat on its head. Indeed, I have decided to leave it for many, many years, looking at its fellow who did wear my hat. Will the hat wearer be apologetic, quietly satisfied? Twice more I walk past and don't reach for the hat, just to tighten up the implications. But the point has been made. I take the hat off. Now, in its identity with all the others, this poppy head is forever different. I think it looks a warmer brown. But I have to admit, when I look at its neighbour, too, from the back, that is, if anything, browner. And of course, my own head, when I try the hat on, is a bench end. Oh yes, it was strange to walk right away up to the chancel screen and turn back and see the hat far off, suggesting someone sitting with his back to me. Another person in the church, stiller than I had been. I placed my hand on the shoulder of the bench end while it was still wearing the hat, in a friendly way. The hardness of the thin wood conveyed determination not to look a fool, not to give way at all. Its coolness was a little like shaking me off, refusing comradeship. Stop this foolery. Now I have the hat again, and benches can be benches. No, not so. Never, I guess, again. The sun has flooded another poppy head now, one in the benches parallel to the aisle, up by the altar. Choir benches. All the details of this poppy head are enhanced. Its grooves darker, its grain clearer, the tip of its head and ears touched up. I speculate on putting the hat on it. It calls out for it. Instead, I stand at the back of the aisle and toss the hat up over the rows of benches towards the front, to see it fly, to hear it drop, to see it land on that illuminated poppy head. It doesn't reach the front, but planes sideways to the right and flops down weakly in a rather muffled, unreal way, not smacking down but sounding broken and inconsiderable. I go and stand by the sunlit bench end that it didn't reach, and of course it is the one with the knot hole in its heart. And now, years afterwards, the hat has worn out, with a hole where I repeatedly pinched its crown to take it off. The hat is finished with, yet it is not. Here it is now. I can feel the peak of it between my thumb and the inside of my forefinger.
I hereby call this meeting of the RF Langley Fan Club to order. The RF Langley Land Club. Right, welcome back. To the second half, it will follow pretty much the format of the first. First, we will hear a poem from Eric Langley, Roger's son. Now, also a PM review, Carcanet Burt himself. We'll hear from Roger's old friend Jeremy Prynne, also a poet himself. another poet, a long-term admirer of Roger's work, Matthew Welton. Then we'll hear from Helen MacDonald, originally a poet, now also a wonderful writer of prose about the natural world. And finally we will hear from, that's right, you guessed it, a poet, Peter Gizzi, who is currently the Judith E. Wilson Fellow in Poetry at the University of Cambridge, and one of the growing number of American admirers of this English poet. And Peter will be reading Two Nightingale, which was the last poem that was published. And without further ado, I'll hand you over to Eric.
I'm a Shakespeare lecturer at UCL. I publish with Carcanet and peer review. Seems like I'm haunted somehow. So I'm going to read Mariana, and I just want to preface my reading by indulging in what Dad described in one of his letters to me as, quote, a bit of etymological fretting. taking my cue from two lines of Mariana. Firstly, the poem's opening three words. Sorry, I am an English lecturer, I think I'm allowed to do this. And looking out. And secondly, from a bit of wordplay from the third stanza, where the poet's attention to the drawling light and the quiet squall of Martin's wings again, is described as an attentive act of selling out and buying in. Selling out and buying in. You may remember that Shakespeare's Prospero, another rather stern, bearded father, continually
insists.
At least I'm not using Hamlet, Jeremy. That would be worse. Continually insists that his inattentive child, Miranda, ope thine ear and be attentive. Dost thou attend, he says. In a similar way, the reader of Dad's poems feels the imperative in his words to spend attention, to attentively buy in to the world, to invest attention, to attend for an extended period. To be attentive is etymologically to stretch out, to pay out one's senses, to extend towards the object of your attention. All of these words, extend, attend, all come from the Latin tendere, to stretch. And so, for example, we read elsewhere in Dad's poems of a Titian painting where the brush calls your attention to the jaw, to both lips, to the nostril, the eyelid, and we feel this kind of generous sensory extenuation, another word that comes from tendere, the stretching out, the extending of attention across a picture plane. So for Mariana in this poem, the first three lines and looking out, first three words and looking out, to be looking out, or for her to be the lookout, involves a reaching out or an extension of the senses into the world for the lover who may or may not come. And of course, if you are a lookout, you must also be prepared to look out for someone, to look out for them, to look after them, to allow oneself to become tendere to the world, to risk becoming, as Prospero himself discovers, vulnerable to tender contact, to be tenderized. In these poems, therefore, quote, each seed is caught in its place, tilting its face, very tenderly presented to the air, tendered up, tendered out to an invested, attentive reader. And accordingly, therefore, the air of each poem vibrates with tenderness. Selling out, buying in. We are asked to sell ourselves out and to buy back in. To invest in the world and to invest the world back in us. We're asked to take, in other words, the tender risk that such attentive investment in a potentially tenderizing world must involve, because it is, as the wordplay there acknowledges, a risk that may involve selling ourselves out or buying into a very risky investment. Delicate tenderness, as Shakespeare's Lear tells us, can find itself abused. It's this terrifically extensive but terrifyingly tender extension that I think in these poems opens us up to intense experience, to tensile, taut encounters with the world, high strung and vibrative with tenderness, each brushstroke, as Dad says in one of his journal entries, intensifies the picture. To be intense or intent is, of course, to be attent, to be terrifically strung out, attentive. I wanted to play on attention before reading Mariana because it feels to me to be a word that etymologically, as I hope I've shown, allows both that sense of a generous extension out into the world, a tender openness, but also acknowledges a kind of flinch, the risk of a bad investment selling out, the pain involved in being tenderized or overextended. And I think I've said this because I want to draw attention to the cost, to the risk, and therefore to the ethics of paying attention in Dad's poetry, which is not just about soft contact or a kind of gentle contact with the natural world, but is in fact a poetry that asks about the cost of investment in a world like that of Mariana, where we are jolted by tilting shadows, where sometimes love, as in the source text, does not come, where we're compelled to see, and where even little cute chubby cupids demand our heads for what they steal. So, ope thine ears and be attentive, Mariana. And looking out, she might have said, we could have all of this, and would have meant the serious ivy on the 13 trunks, the ochre field behind, soothed passage of the cars, slight pressure of the sparrows' chirps, just what the old glass, gently tested, bending, she would have meant, and not a dream ascending. And looking in, she might have seen the altering cream of unemphatic light across the bevel of the ceiling's beam, and shaken by the flare of quiet wings around the room as martins hovered at the guttering, she might have soon settled for these things, without the need for certainties elsewhere. So, please, she would have said. We could, she would have said. And maybe, mildly. Then, selling out, buying in the drawing light and the quiet squall of Martin's wings, again, again, she might have soon discerned herself seeing them. Not things, but seeing things, and with such care, it would be like being shown what was not there. It was the old glass cooled the colours and transposed them in a different key. It chastened most of what the sparrow said and made an affilatura of the tree. She would have known the consolation that it gave and smiled to see the unthought of tricks she needed and the sort of liar she was, or might soon be. As things came in, and as they spread and sprayed, she could have tilted up her face in the soft fuss they made, encouraging the cheat with shivering lashes, tremulo, fermo, wide or tight, intending to confuse her sight until, perhaps, she dared to make a try to find her own Cupid in her own eye. For such a scene, amongst such possibilities, the downright matter-of-fact determination of ivy on the trees, wriggling queerly under the examination of the glass, the steady, sunlit room, fluttered by each martin as it made its pass. To all of this, she might have deftly given a lash, until there were sequins in the air, and surreptitious cupids glancing everywhere. They pricked their wings, their arrows spun away with thinnest silver chirruping. They were miraculous, picked by her to be beyond belief, believing them. The lie she told to throw the truth into relief, into the pure relief of ordinary light. But now she must have all of this, compelled to see by possibility just what the glass finds real enough to bend, jolted by tilting shadows that the martins send, seized by the amarini, who, being unreal, demand her head
for what they steal.
This is a particularly rich moment, and it's wonderful to be part of it. I brought with me, just because this is a kind of backward look or travel growth, a painting that Roger did, a kind of sketch, and it's dated very precisely the 29th of October, 1961. That was done when they were still in the Midlands, and we can't project it on the screen because the screen won't do it for us. So I'll just hold it up and let you have a look. And when my session is over, you can all come and have a closer look if you like. We've got the larger and much larger work of which it is based on this exactly same view, hangs in Barbara Langley's loo, is it probably? Somewhere down in the Langley household. And this sketch I discovered when clearing out some stuff. I haven't seen it for 50 years, and here it is now getting its first airing. It's a very vortices piece with various other interests folded into it, and it's a powerful and interesting reminder of Roger's work as a painter. Anyway, what am I going to do? I'm going to read the first original Man Jack poem. Man Jack has already been introduced to us, so we have an idea about why Jack was significant to Roger. Over quite a period of time, he became a kind of avatar figure, a kind of mischief figure, almost a kind of Shakespearean fool. And there's no doubt that Roger played with this idea and got great pleasure from doing so. He was, it's easy to think of Roger as a very serious man. And of course he was very serious about the things that mattered, but he was also extremely playful, and wickedly playful too. He had a quite adroit sense of humour, sometimes at the wrong occasion, and there's no point in trying to make him seem like a kind of solemn philosophical sage, because that was only part of his story. But the Man Jack business now, how are we going to place this? I'm going to tell two little anecdotes to get us going. Not really directly related, anyway, the first not directly related, and it's really the interest that we've had so far this evening. When Roger was a student, and I was a student, in 1957? We were very sproggy new students. It was a long time ago now. And we arrived in our place of study, stunned with the amazement of actually being there. And our first task was to sally out into the town and buy a kettle. We all had gas rings, and we all, gas rings, can you imagine? And we all cooked up coffee on the gas rings, and in order to do this, you had to have a kettle, and so you had to go around to Woolworths, as it then was, and buy a kettle, a whistling kettle. But because this whistling kettle was a mark of shameful novelty, I mean, we were such novices, such newcomers, that we attempted to conceal how hopelessly new we were, so our kettles were always wrapped in brown paper to conceal the fact that we just bought a kettle. So we sallied out into the town, and we, both of us together, bought kettles and wrapped them in brown paper, and the whistles were safely enclosed in the brown wrapping. I invite you to reflect on this point. The whistles were wrapped in brown paper. They were ready to whistle. That was to be their future life. But they were not yet ready to divulge our connection with the notion of their whistle and our provision. So the whistle was a secret, hidden bargain that was yet to be tried. And we took these whistles home and put them on our gas rings. And from then on, they were a part of our daily lives. So the whistling kettle was an episode which I only remembered very recently, and I thought, there's a story in this. There's a landing type story in this. These hidden whistles are part of his story as they are part of mine. Now I'm going to tell you another story, much more recent, well, recent-ish. It's probably in the notebook somewhere, and those who know the notebooks well may recognise this story. We were on holiday together in Suffolk, as we often were. We would hobble up together and prowl about and look at things and exchange ardent conversations about every possible kind of topic. And on one occasion, looking out on the back patio, the back terrace of the house where we were, I don't know, we must have rented it from somewhere, the Westleton perhaps, there was a blackbird, a male blackbird, on the little raised stone rockery, performing bizarre antics. I'd never seen a blackbird behave like this before. I was not an ardent ornithologist the way Roger was. My kingdom was plants. But I knew enough about birds, and blackbirds in particular, to know that this was very unusual behaviour. What was he doing, this bird? He was pecking about in the stones at the top of this rockery. And after he pecked around a little in the stones, he would raise a wing and with his beak, pop his beak up under his wing and rummage in the feathers and push about and wriggle with a certain amount of obvious excitement, and then would do the whole process again. Beak down into the top of the rockery, rummage, pick up some object, some things, raise his wings, pop it up under his wing, and again, push it up, and derive from the experience obvious excitement. What were they? They were ants. And he was performing what's known as anting. He was anting. He was wild with excitement for popping these ants under his wings and getting the thrill of their little bites, their little formic injections. He knew how to do this, and he knew how it affected him, and he went all around the bed and drawing this procedure. I thought, that's what poets do. You get the thing that really riles you up, and you pop it up somewhere where it counts, it doesn't work, and in no time at all, you've done something exciting. Roger's particular skill, I think, was in dictionaries. He really loved rummaging in dictionaries, and in particular the great etymological dictionary of Walter Skeat. Before the more recent affairs of a more recent vintage, Skeat was the final authority in the derivation of English words, and Roger had this book constantly at his elbow and would rummage about in it over and over frequently again. This poem that I'm going to read, of course, when I finish all this rigmarole, Man Jack, contains a good deal of material from Skeat's dictionary. One word in particular, which he gives quite an interesting run to, is the word gleek. Gleek, Roger loved obscure words, and gleek is obscure enough. It was an old word, meaning a set of three, or trio. It was a kind of game that you could play, obviously involved playing with numbers, and it was a verb which meant to gleek, was to taunt, or to make pointed jokes. There's a reference in Roger's favourite Shakespeare play, in the Midsummer Night's Dream, when Bottom, who is being courted in a rather fantastic way by Titania, turns to her and says, "Nay, I can greet upon occasion," as if he's good at making pointed jokes rather specifically pointed jokes, no doubt, as Titania was the first quickly to understand. So these exotic words, the poem also contains the word mourning vow, which is an extremely rare word. I don't know where Roger got that from, because it doesn't figure in Greek dictionary at all. He must have got it from the OED, where it does figure. It's a very obscure word, but it has a wonderful little run in this poem. And the whole poem is about playing games and games of various kinds. And it's very domestic and very beautiful, because I remember the occasion so well. Man Jack is dedicated for Jane Williams and Bob Walker. Bob Walker was a student of Roger's, who was then a student of mine. He was a very, very sweet man. He wrote a lot of poems. I don't think he ever did very much with his poems, but I have in my lair a box load of poems by Bob Walker, beautiful things, and very characteristic of the values which he shared with his teacher, Roger, and with me when we were all together. And Jane Williams was pregnant, was about to produce an offspring, and there was this play, because in Suffolk at that time, there were no mobile phones, of course, absolutely not, and there were no household phones either, so the only way you could communicate when you were living out in the wild in Suffolk was through the telephone box. At the top of the roadway, up from the place where we all lived, there was this isolated phone box. And you could send messages from it, and you could receive messages into it, if you knew how to get the number right. And so we would go up to the phone box and loiter, waiting for messages to come through the ether to tell us what was new about Jane's situation. It was an amazing occasion. I remember it vividly. The telephone box, I could guide you to it now, if it probably BT has had it removed by now, the way that the new panels arrangements go. But I know where it would be, and possibly it's still there. And if it's still there, we should have a Langley pilgrimage to the phone box to revive this ancient ceremonial connection. Anyway, this is enough chit chat. I don't think there's any more I need to tell you about. Oh, yes, there is. This whole business, the Jack business, the Man Jack business, where does it come from? What are its names? Well, there are many, many different answers to this question. But one particular answer, which is of some interest, is a book. I don't know how old Roger knew this book. This is a book called The Englishman's Flora by Geoffrey Grigson, a well-known critic and poet of that era. And he collected this range of knowledge about plants based on popular nomenclature, the names that ordinary people gave to plants. And long before I knew Roger, I knew Jack by the Hedge, which was wild garlic, and it was called Jack by the Hedge, and one of the Jack figures in the plant names of the English vernacular tradition. And Geoffrey Grigson's book has in the index, I brought it with me so as to make this point more vividly, in the index, not complicated index as I would know. I'll get to it in a moment. It can't be far away here. Here we are, yes. Jack. Here are some plant names. Jack and the Beanstalk, Jack at the Hedge, Jack by the Hedge, Jack by the Hedgeside, Jack Durrells, Jack Flower, Jack go to bed at noon, Jack Horner, Jack in the Bush, Jack in the Box, Jack in the Bushes, Jack in the Green, Jack in the Hedge, Jack in the Lantern, Jack in the Pulpit, Jack Jennets, Jack Jumpabout, Jack of both sides, Jack of the Buttery, Jack of the Hedge, Jack of Lanterns, Jack of two sides, Jack of running along by the hedge, Jack come in the country, Jack run by the hedge, These are all with plant names with particular regions associated. Many are Devonshire or Somerset, but all over Britain. This range of jacks is very, very characteristic and very amusing, and Roger must have found these plant names a rich source of vernacular playfulness. They're all vernacular, they're all part of the spoken traditions of British country life, and Roger had a big feel for this. Here is Birdsfoot Trefoil, I believe, the more well-known plant name, which has a fantastic number of pseudonyms. Grits and comments, when a species has been endowed with more than 70 names, I mean, it is a small plant, however common, to which people could very well have been indifferent, one has to look for reasons. Then he gives an account of this plant and of its particular history and of the values that were attached to it in the medieval period and thereafter. And the nicknames that are attached to it, very numerous, very amusing, very sportive and playful. These are all words that gave a great richness to Roger's sense of the vernacular, the natural, the quick life in the world around you. If you pay attention and observe it closely, you can find these cues, these clues to the naturalness of life. And Roger was so quick to see these things. When we went on the visits in the wilds of Suffolk, he used to say, it'll take us 2 or 3 days to get our eyes in. For the first couple of days, we won't really see anything. We won't see the telling detail. We won't see the particular unexpected features of the world around us because our eyes are blunted by big attention to daily, commonplace things. But once you start to look and you clear your eyes and you clear your attention and you shut down your mind, all that silly nonsense about work and interest and all the rest of that, you get a clear mind and you open your eyes and then your eyes gradually assimilate features. You see a pair of aphids climbing on each other's backs and you think, well, they can't be reproducing because they don't reproduce like that. There must be some, they're milking each other, that's what they're doing. They're extracting this sticky milk from each other with their little tentacles, scraping it off each other's backs. And it's just, you've got to look very, very closely to see them. But if you look closely, you can see what they're doing, that maybe like the blackbirds, you just have to pay attention. And once you get down to the specific, minute, momentary detail of the thing, it's there, and you know. And you know it, you know, and the whole world opens in a different way. So that's my little introduction. And now we're going to come to the main jack pine itself. Here we go. For Jane Williams and Bob Walker. So, Jack's your man. Jack is your man in things. And he must come along. And he must stay close, be quick and right. Your little cousin, Jack, a step ahead, deep in the hedge, on edge, a kiss, a rim, at pinch, in place, turn, face, and tip a brim. Each inch of him, the folded leaf, the important straw. What for? What for? He's slippery and hot. He slides in blood. Those lies he tells you, running alongside, to and fro he ducks, and miserably clicks and puckers up, and in his rage he won't speak out, or only half. He's short. He's dim. He'll clench his jaw. He's more than you can take. He'll drop it all across the road and spit and go. Over the years you'll have to learn to pull him in and let him know. You'll say, tomorrow we will have that. Now, those other apples. So, oh, but you'll fetch them, like I seem to think I dreamt you did. And they'll be like they always should have been. In action, apples, in the apples, 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 through and through. And then you'll see what he can do. He'll fetch them in and put them roughly in a row. The scent will almost be a presence in the room. Oh, but it hurt, he'll say, to pick across the stones, the different stones. so many different pains. Oh, Jack, you Hick, you Grig, you Hob, you Tom and whatnot. With your moans, your bones are rubber. Get back out and do it all again. For all the world an ape. For all the world Tom Poke, Tom Tickle and Tom Joke. Go back and carry logs into the hall. And wait with lifted finger till the eavesdrops fall. Your task, the jewel discovered by the monkey in the shine. Fetch that and make it much, and mine. Sometimes it's best if I forget to ask. An errand boy with nothing up his sleeve, who stops to listen to the rigmarole, to find he cannot leave without he's brought the dog. Time out of mind. Just bring what you can find. Apples, twigs, icicles, pigs. The owl that watches as we try a phone call from the isolated box. Jane's disembodied voice. The owl that hears her words. The moon that thinks about her baby. Jack in the moon. Jane in June. The baby coming sure and soon and bright and staring at the apples which keep still. The owl had no idea. More knew Tom Fool. The apples shine in everybody's eyes. Tom speaks inside his cheeks. The moon talks from inside his belly. The isolation sighs to think of motherhood. We hear Jane's tiny words as of the owl, astonished, listening in the roadside wood. Jack bleats inside his only box of tricks for what has come. All thumbs, he tips his tongue, its apples and its owls. He bobs and chops and nips until it's still engaged in paradise with the enchanted pits. They're from the Hobart, I'm sure. Just in the nick with only magic left. No use at all to look at him as if he were a jug, as if he were a twig, is evidently a love bouquet. The apples are a gift. The spellbound owl sits round as such upon a shelf. Its silence cries out loud as if you touch it on a wound. It is embarrassed and delighted with what Jack has found, and that it had itself the wit required to secretly decipher it, until there is a sudden dip into a silence in the silence, and the owl has turned his head away and, frightened, stepped off on his long legs into air, into an emptiness left by Jack, who is not there. He's gone too far. Though nothing drops, there's nothing caught. The twig is two. The gleek is three. There'd be a morning bowel in the four, but no one's counting anymore. It stops. The apple is not fire. And yellow is not sweet. Jane's voice from miles away is just a speck, almost lost, but yet it is distinctly Jane, uninfluenced by the moon she has not seen, the roadside where she has not been, the owl who thought to pick a peck, the apples that she will never eat, the Jane who cannot tell us yet the baby's name. And undeclared like that, it wins the game. Thank you.
Good evening. It's an honor, a privilege to be taking part tonight. In 2002, I was one of a team of editors who were working on the Poetry Journal, Stand magazine, and as Stand reached its 50th anniversary, we figured that we would have a celebration reading. And it was an evening, in some ways, not unlike this evening, except much of the poetry was perhaps of a quite different type. And there were three of us who were editors, and at the time there was, I can't remember the name of the position, it was something like editorial assistant, which at the time the job was being done by a woman called Debbie Krupski. And we were sitting around the Stand offices at Leeds University and making a list of the poets that we were going to invite to take part in this reading. And Debbie said, we could ask the father of my friend Eric. And I said, who's that? And she said, that's our family. And I had no idea that there was a connection to Leeds at the time. And indeed, Eric was later to take over from Debbie doing that job at Stand. And that was going to be the first time that I heard Roger Reed, and the first time that I met him. And I was really, really looking forward to the evening. And I didn't even know what he looked like, and was sort of mildly intimidated at the prospect of this poet whose work I loved so much. And Roger was scheduled to read in the second half that night. And a bunch of us travelled over from Manchester, and during the interval I was chatting to the poet Michael Simmons Roberts, and Michael said to me, I think I'm sitting in the same row as R.F. Langley. And I was like, oh yeah, have you been talking to him? And he said, no, but there's this guy who, during everybody's reading so far, has been sighing and huffing and saying, it's like nothing has happened in poetry in the last 100 years. A little while after that, we were fortunate that Roger sent us a poem for publication in Stand, and that's the poem that I'm going to read now. It's called Depending on the Weather. Is one of the pair of poems that, subsequent to its publication in Stand, was published in the pamphlet Twine by Jeremy Altot's Landfill Press, before it eventually went into Carcanet's books by Roger, Depending on the Weather. The hurry to bite that runs over the spare tanks, with his head high, with his bulging eyes. He swerves with the weave, expecting his next success. Premise. The beetle believes that he knows what the wasp is thinking. The beetle believes he knows what the wasp is thinking of him, the green beetle. What she sees, he might mean. His needles winking and the wicked cut of his jaws. The beetle believes he knows what the wasp thinks the beetle is thinking about them both. All their embroidery, his nip, his stitch, the set of grapples in his grin, the rich twist of his ewe, his green knee, two to embrace, then the toils we intended to trace, the last clasp, about how clever to run through what needs must be done to be stitched up as them, as the beetle and wasp, woven deep in and ready to work. But what we remember, both, as anyone should, is this shock of this buzz of these silvery wings. The classic malevolence of the evil fairy, or your own ill treatment of the poor. She passed by the door, speaking nothing. Then she instantly returned with a like look, and in the same silence departed. The new wheat cake I was chewing
fell from my mouth, myself in a trembling, myself off my stool, sewed in a stocking, stuck in my fit. I believe the old widow knew well enough what went right to my heart, what I ought with my cake, for the sake of a silent rebuke. My neighbour, the witch, who was after my cookies, eye on me as if she were Atropos, green as a beetle that studies to bite through these golden curls, the twirls of a wasp round a hot pocket of sand, as if it were checking its property, combing out honey, the kingdom of spin and snip, a bobbing bobbin, the hank and the quill of our hungry fate. Escape that. We both think we will. Imagine the beetle imagining the wasp, imagining what would be involved in keeping a diary. I should have risked more, done nothing, taken half maybe, never the whole bake. But it's a fact, no peas would then grow in the field. They were unable to make butter or cheese, and that was it. A fly? Always the same fly? In summer weather, it would shuffle through the glints and darkness looming in a room. Far too familiar, they said. Doubtless a part of her repertoire. Some point of view, some plenitude and cogency. Really? Nonplussed on the glass, it knocks against the white outside. It taps. His angry fingernail. Tap, tap. Some pretty agony. 11 women, all acquitted, and it seems to me, believing nothing of the witchery. He sat up straight, as if the sky were resting on his head. The wasp breathes on. The beetle rips up what is left. The beetle believes that you are watching it. It lifts its chin, looks at you, and gets ready to unsheathe its wings. The fascination of a magician is ever by the eye into the heart. Mine aches. Dread hunts my ground as a tiger beetle, reaves my quiet as a wasp. I learn their manners and disguise myself as them, but their movements figure out themselves. They never choke on cake. It's a mistake to wish that they could speak. They pass on this and that. Most of this kind do take to the air at once, not saying a word. And he cheerfully greeted the more sensational testimony with the remark that he knew of no law against flying. Staggered, they went out into the day. Blind, reeling with freedom. Who cares what they thought that they thought that they thought? All such repertoires are put to bed. The blanket design was an old one. Easy to pick out, worn to a thread. Thank you.
Hello. I was thinking this morning about the first time I met Roger. It was back in the early 1990s. It was my first poetry festival up in Newcastle under Lyme. We turned up from the train station. I was terrified. We ended up meeting, as was the wont in those days, and probably sinners, in a pub before the festival started. And there'd been a lock-in the previous night, and it was still going on. And we all turned up into this, it was a proper old pub with kind of syrupy tables that were slightly sticky. And we all sat down. And these old boys at the back wanted to know who the hell we were. We didn't look like the normal clientele. And they discovered we were poets. And one of them laughed out loud and said, "I've got a poem for you," he said. "My head's a cathedral, and my drinking's illegal." And that was the first poetry I ever heard at a poetry festival. And Roger was speaking that afternoon, and I'd not heard of his poetry before, I'd not read any of his poetry before, I didn't really know who he was, to my great shame, this is way back when. And he started talking about his poems. And as he was talking, I thought, they can't be this good. And they were better. And I remember sitting on a really uncomfortable chair, watching a shaft of light through a window with dust motes romantically floating around in it. And I was astonished and I was in love with this poetry. And I still am, and I still think it's extraordinary, and I still think the journals are among the best natural history writing that has ever been written. And I'm still in awe of them. And they scare me a bit. So I'm going to start reading, or do a reading, from the 14th of January 2005, which starts with the sentence, "One could ask oneself why one was frightened." One could ask oneself why one was frightened. This would risk finding something which makes it more frightening once found. What is there here to discover? Whatever it is will surely come first as an image, a memory. It will come with an uneasiness difficult to pin down rather than an extended mood. The uneasiness will be the more disturbing because it will insist that it is there to be clarified if you go into it further. Already, I have an image. A duck is turning on water, holding its head high and slightly tilted, looking about. It is a drake scorp. And I saw it on Bennock Abroad the day before yesterday. Its head was dark, but definitely cobalt turquoise, precisely that as a gloss on the dark feathers. The green of a mallard, but not so green, more hidden. And wet, because the bird had just surfaced from a dive. It is January and cold. The water must be numbingly cold. The bird rows itself around, curving across the choppy wavelets. I doubt if it matters that it is a scorp, beyond the fact that I would not have been looking at it so carefully had it been a mallard. Or perhaps what I am thinking now gives importance to the precise image, if, though before I thought it, each detail did not matter so much. The duck was not in any way close to me. I was a watcher. No matter what the physical distance was between myself and the bird, no matter that I was seeing it through binoculars so that what was there was very clear, the distance between us was absolute and the bird was unreachable. Once noticed, this distance was not only a feature of the scorp on water, it instantly became the way the water's urgency conveyed itself, made its way past in detail. Sky blue dropped on it, silver flash and flink off it, and cold, of course, but not at all close. In fact, unreachable. Also, the cold, stiff, scratchable wood of the planks of the hide, you could work on them, pry off splinters or run your thumb on the smooth edge of the shutter, twist the metal butterfly nut that held the shutter open, a rather tricky nut, which wobbled on its screw, but none of this would bring anything closer. No closer than the cobalt turquoise shine way out there on the scorp's head, turning about to sleep with wet. Someone had collected rubbish from the beach, scraps of fishing net, polystyrene packing in a plastic sack, and had left it just inside the door of the hide, where it rustled and jerked in the wind, sudden jumpy, squeaky sounds, which you could not hope to hold close. Maybe when something feels close in the way I'm looking for, one feels that some heed has been taken of it, to hold it and keep it. Ostensibly this was true of the items in the bag of rubbish, but not in the important way. They were only left as collected. When the requisite heed has been not being taken, things are loose. However rigidly they keep still, however they flap in the wind, there is no guarantee they are firm. Hard probably, cold yes, wet after a dive, all of it in quite bright January winter light with nothing to depress you in that other than the clarity of it, which showed so much that did not cheer. However, they are not given the close guarantee. They hold a position only because there seems no such thing as being in position. They take place, though there seems nothing that can be in place properly. I suppose this is it. Things had just come, and having done that, there was no closer to come. Close. Claws. Shut into clauses. In sentences. Of course, one can interfere with the lack of closeness by writing about it. You close in on the head of the scorp like that. But it loses the quality it had before it seemed possible to write about it, which was that it was not close, that it was not coming nearer, that it was, all the time you were aware of it, coming away. Being nearer physically often makes things further away. Nothing is more distant than the sunlit hairs on the back of my hand which glimmer like the gloss on the scorp's head.
and perhaps an experience comes off only before it's possible to write about it. When comes off carries a twofold suggestion. First, the shock of the happening, the chance of its coming about, of events coming off that way, turning out to be unexpectedly in place. Secondly, the sense of something going, slipping away, getting loose, falling off. The arrival and the loss feel bound to happen together.
It's really wonderful to be part of this evening. To add a voice from a different place. I am one of the many growing readers of Langley's work in America. But I'd like to begin by saying that we're celebrating this book, but a book needs an editor. So I think we should give an applause for Jeremy Noel Todd and the excellent work that he's done. So I have a few remarks, they're short. I had the good fortune to hear R.F. Langley read at a poetry festival in Cambridge. He read, coincidentally, with Helen MacDonald. And their program was far and away my favorite of that visit. I instantly got a copy of his chapbook and was struck by the rightness of his voice and his ability to manipulate psychic interiority with and through physical objects. His poems are not mere observation, though perception figures large. They do something further. They locate us always exactly where we already are, at the edge of meaning, in an already impacted, developing world. His poems begin in the midst of action, but their angle of perception is oblique or slant, as Emily Dickinson might say. In this way, the poem, like the world, exists phenomenally. It is grasped as it is coming into being, and he records the outer edges of the context of this movement, placing the poem at the horizon of our understanding. It's as though his outside, his sense of an objective world, is the reading of an after-image flashed upon the optic nerve. It can create a nervy tableau where color shift and sound is three-dimensional. In this synesthesia, we find world in ourselves impressed in his process. In this activity, this need to capture, Langley is an ecstatic, perhaps even a devotional thinker, though he is neither overtly moral nor pious. In these visions of excess, he is profoundly genuine in his arduous humility to get it right. I was asked to read his magnificent poem To a Nightingale. In this poem, Langley is taking in the material world for an instant and orchestrating it into a coherent sound. Coherent in the sense that it's lasting sound. I would also like to add, I think it takes a lot of inner confidence to write a poem in England called To a Nightingale, and then produce one of the finest examples of what a lyric poem can be in our time. R.F. Langley has made a serious contribution to this art, and as a poet, I can only read his work with gratitude, and it is a privilege to read this poem to you tonight. To a Nightingale. Nothing along the road but petals, maybe, pink behind and white inside. Nothing but the coping of a bridge, mutes on the bricks hard as putty, then in the sun as metal. Burls of grimia, hairy, hoary, with their seed capsules uncurling, red mites bowling about on the baked lichen, in what look like casual landing strike flies, Helena faunia, could they be? This month the lemon, I'll say, primrose colors, moths which flinch along the hedge, then turn in to hide our yellow shells, not shaded broadsides. Lines waver. Kanto Brahma, heat off the road in the knick-knack of names, Scitopteryx, Darkwing, the flutter, doubles and blurs the margin, Fuscus and white, stop at nothing, to stop here at nothing as a chaffinch sings interminably all day. A chiff-chaff, purring of two turtle doves, voices, and some vibrate with tenderness. I say none of this for love. It is anyone's gif-gaff. It is anyone's kelka shows. No business of mine. Mites which ramble, caterpillars which curl up as question marks. Then one note, five times, louder each time, followed after a fraught pause by a soft cuckle of wet pebbles, which I would call a glottal rattle. I am empty, stopped at nothing, as I wait for this song to shoot. The road is rising as it passes the apple tree and makes its approach to the bridge. Thank you, Roger. Thank you.
Wow. That concludes our wonderful reading by Peter. Our readings this evening. Colin here has recorded them all and is now packing up so that he can catch his train back to London. And I know that it has been quite an evening of attentiveness, so I won't take any more of your attention other than to thank Writers Centre for hosting us this evening in this wonderful building here at Dragon Hall. To thank School of Literature, Drama and Creative Writing at UEA for supporting the readings like this that we organise as the UEA Poetics Project. To thank Carcanet and PM Review for furnishing us both with wine and magazines. What more does one need in life? Thanks to Colin for recording what we've been saying. Thanks to Fern, who not only read, but also has taken some photographs this evening. And I think that's all I really want to say, other than just quite how memorable all this has been for me. I will think of it every time now as I look at those poems, and despite having edited them, I do look at those poems all the time. But thank you, readers, for bringing them alive for us again in so many unique and personal ways. I'll just ask you to join me in thanking those readers.